Okay, so last time I was trying to tell you, give you a feel for what modes are, how they geographically sample the Earth, mainly in radius, but also laterally, and talk a little bit about how we estimate these mode frequencies. I didn't get too much of that, but we do it by either taking modes apart and really looking at the splitting, which is caused, actually in this case, it's mainly caused by rotation of the Earth, but it's also caused by 3D structure, and actually assigning a very accurate center frequency to this mode, a degenerate frequency that the mode would have if the Earth were spherically symmetric. We can do this for a lot of modes, or we can take combinations and play with all the singlets in a mode, which we call then a multiplet, and try and estimate the center frequencies very precisely too. And this is done, this is an old example. Now we do this by geographic collection of records, looking at certain great circle paths and try and get the geographic variation of these peaks too, to get a really good accurate center frequency. So we got all these center frequencies, and now I want to try and tell you what we can learn about the Earth from them. So these are the solid dots are the ones that have been observed. This actually goes off in this direction quite a way. And there are about 550 spheroidal modes that have been observed. The red guys, as you now know, are the core, inner core modes and their overtones, and they're not going to be observed. And these blue guys you can't really see are the core mantle stony modes, and they're not going to be observed. So we've observed quite a lot of the available modes up to 100-second period, even up to 80-second period. You'll see a lot of these low group velocity pseudobranches here, which are the PCP and the SCS equivalent modes, are not well observed, and I'm not really quite sure why that is, but we have a hard time getting those out. Okay, so we have those. We have toroidal modes from transverse components. Okay, and so we have about 900 total, and we want to play the game of looking at the Earth. And of course, the primary thing that you do with these data is to make 1D Earth models. And so all you need is a little bit of math perturbation equation. And this kind of equation just crops up all the time in mode analysis. Even when you're dealing with split modes, we get equations like this, that there's some kernel, in this case with VPVS and rho, which look very much like those compressional energy and shear energy density kernels that you've been playing with on the computer. And so these are wiggly functions, or sometimes exponential functions, of depth inside the Earth. And because we have lots of different kinds of modes, we have lots of different wiggly functions which we're sampling the Earth with. All right, so we can have a reasonable expectation that by putting all this information together, we'll be able to learn about structure on fairly narrow length scales inside the Earth. All right, so that's what we do. You can invert this any way you like, and take the observations and get estimates of perturbations in velocity from the starting model. And this is the standard picture that you see. We actually, it turns out we have some new models that are pretty much Prem-like, except that we are able to get rid of this somewhat unpleasant 220 kilometer discontinuity, which exists in Prem and is basically an artifact of the parameterization. You can get rid of this if you extend the anisotropy. This is transverse isotropy here in the upper mantle down a little deeper, and everything can be made to be smoothly connecting. So we know the 220 doesn't exist globally from underside precursors to the 660 and the 410, which we see, but we don't see underside precursors on a global scale to the 220. So it's not a global feature, but it is in Prem. So that's one of the things, if you're not a seismologist, that you should bear in mind when you're looking at the fit of your mineral physics model to an Earth model, is that some of these Earth models have some funky things that that actually don't exist anywhere inside the Earth. But, okay. All right. Now, making models is all well and good, but what you guys probably would like to know is just how well the density and the compressional velocity and the shear velocity is actually determined. Is it 10%, 5%, 1%, or whatever? All right, so And modes was actually the example that was used in the 60s and early 70s by Bex and Gilbert to develop their resolving power theory. And I'm going to show you some resolution calculations done basically using Backus-Gilbert theory. So I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about what that is. So let's just look at the simplest linear, well, I guess this is a linearized inverse problem. We have a perturbation in frequency is equal to some kernel times a perturbation in a model parameter. And actually, we have three of these, right? We have VP, VS, and rho, but for simplicity, let's just do this. And we take a linear combination of data, okay, which looks like this over here. These we know, we can compute these for the Earth in those wiggly functions. And we're going to choose these coefficients in here to make this thing be as delta-like as possible. All right? So we're going to take all our data, which sampled the Earth with various wiggly functions, and we're going to make a datum which hopefully would have zero sensitivity everywhere except to some certain depth range inside the Earth. So we're trying to make very special data out of all the data that God gave us. All right, and if we could do that, then this linear combination of perturbations in frequency, these would be perturbations, the observed frequencies minus the model frequency, where this would be the model, starting model, say. Then what you would get would be the difference between the real Earth at this radius here, R naught, minus the model at that radius, R naught. Okay, so that would be the ideal case. Now, you're not going to be able to make a delta function. If you had an infinite number of perfectly accurate data, you might actually get pretty close to a delta function. But we have a finite number on the order of 1,000, and moderately precise, but they still are not perfectly accurate data. So we can't do a delta function here, but we can do something like this, okay? Or we can make a boxcar if we want to, right? But it's not going to be perfectly narrow. It's going to have some width associated with it. So this is what we try and do is to choose these A's to make this thing as peaked as possible, localized around some depth. Okay, and then we get some kind of average now of this thing averaged over this kernel, which we call a local average. All right, now, so we're choosing these AKs to get this thing to be very peaked. But this local average also has an error associated with it because each of these observations has an error associated with it, okay? So what, you know, just from loosely speaking, if I have delta omega k plus or minus sigma k, then I'm going to have an error, like sigma ak, the sum of all those errors. Of course, you have to work with the variance, but don't worry about that. But the point is that this local average is going to have some uncertainty because of the uncertainties in the data. All right? And what you want to do is to choose the aks here to minimize that uncertainty, right? So we want the AKs here to do two things. We want them to localize information about a certain radius, and we want to make this combination be as precise as possible so that this thing is precisely known, all right? It's no good localizing information about some radius and depth if that information is very imprecisely known. And if I can tell you what the density is at a depth of 2,000 kilometers plus or minus 100%, it's not a very useful number. But if I can tell you what the density is averaged over 300 kilometers to 0.5%, all right, then that's a useful compromise. Okay, so that's what we do. We make a compromise between the uncertainty in this estimate due to the errors in the data and our ability to make this delta-like. And you just set up a minimization problem and do that. Okay, so what you're doing is you're taking functions of depth that you look like this, all wiggly functions, and you're combining them together to try and make something that's very spiked. And so, let me just show you how that works. Right. Okay, so this is an example of doing that for density. And what I do is I try and make my local average have some target error. So in this case, I'm choosing 0.5%. All right, and then I find, given that target error, I find the A's which make the information as localized as possible so that my generated datum from all my other datum is as spike-like as possible around some target depth. And you can see you can do a pretty good job, right? And particularly in the mantle, this is coming down inside the Earth. And then this is in the core. And even in the inner core, we don't do too badly. All right, and this is, so we're estimating density. You can think of it as estimating density over this kind of length scale to with an error of 0.5%. All right, which is an interesting level of uncertainty. There are some other lines on here which you will probably have a hard time seeing, and that's because I'm trying to localize information about density, but I also have sensitivity to VP and VS. So when I make my resolving kernel, my thing that's spiked, I have to try and make it be zero when it's sampling the, you know, I can show you the equation. All right, so what we do is we take linear combinations of all of these things, and this is the thing that I would try and make delta-like, and these things I try and make to be zero. Okay, so I'm actually asking my AKs to do quite a lot, but they're doing pretty well. All right, they're you can't actually see these guys. They're there, okay, but they're essentially zero. So I can localize information about density, about some depth inside the Earth quite well, and I can basically get rid of their sensitivity to VP and VS in that process. Is that clear?
Right.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm glad you asked that. This is a funny plot, but this is the width of that kernel as a function of target error level, 0.5%, 1%, 5%, 10%. And if I go much below 0.5%, the widths rapidly get in excess of the radius of the Earth. All right, so even though 0.5% looks good, I can't go down to 0.1% for density. All right, I just lose the ability to do that because the modes are not as sensitive to density as they are to other things. But you can see here that, you know, 0.5%, I have resolving widths in the core of 250 kilometers, and in the mantle, a little less than 200 kilometers. Okay, now I'm lying to you, of course, because I'll explain why I'm lying in a minute. But so this is the formal error analysis, and you can do the same for compression velocity. Okay, and there you can get things to better than 0.1%. So in principle, if I average over 300 kilometers in the mantle, I would know the compression velocity to 0.05%. Okay, so it's just this mode data set is extremely precise, and that's why I'm lying to you. All right, so the reason I'm lying to you is that I'm using this equation, and this equation is a linearization of the problem, right? It's a perturbation, and I'm relating perturbations in frequency to perturbations in velocity. So it's like a Taylor series expansion, right, about the initial state that I'm choosing. And of course, there are higher order terms. So there are terms of order delta m squared out here, just like in any good Taylor series expansion, which I am pretending I can ignore. All right, now, what you do when you do this kind of analysis is you divide everything through by sigma k, so you have everything unit variance, because you'd like the precise data to have more impact than the imprecise data. But you're also implicitly dividing the delta m squared term by sigma k. All right, so if sigma k is tiny, if the error on my mode is tiny, like a part in 10 to the 6 or something, then I effectively blow up this term, all right, and this equation no longer holds. All right, I can't really use the first order term. So if I want to do this, and I actually want to say something about what density is inside the Earth, and I really want everything to be truly linear, so it doesn't matter what starting model I use to first order, then it turns out that one way I can do that is to increase sigma k. So some of these guys I know very accurately, but I have to say, if I want to use this equation, I have to say, I can't use a part 10 to the 6, I can only use things that are bigger than 0.05%. So that's to do a linear analysis like that and to ignore the second order terms, that's what I have to do. Okay, so I have to degrade the information in the mode data set just to keep everything reasonably linear. So, and just for completeness, here's the shear velocity. But these things are these things will be true if my starting model were linearly close to the real Earth, to the point that I could neglect delta m squared divided by my very small errors. All right, and I'm telling you that I don't think I really believe that. So we up the errors, the minimum error that we could use, so that the answers that I get out of this kind of analysis do not depend upon the starting model that I use. So I can use AK135 or PRAM or 1066A. And if everything is linear, then it shouldn't matter. The local averages that I get will be independent of the starting model. All right, so I have degraded the data set so that that is true. All right? Okay, so now we're actually going to say, I mean, this is fun, but you'll notice I haven't told you anything about what shear velocity really is inside the Earth. This is just how well formally it's resolved. So let's see if we can actually do some local averages. And actually, I like using boxcars because I understand what the average means if I use a boxcar resolving kernel. So this is a boxcar resolving kernel for density in the outer core. So if I ask what the density, if I ask what is the mean density in the outer core with an error of 1%, I can make an incredibly good boxcar, right, out of that. So it doesn't have any Gibbs ears phenomenon here, all right? And this is 0.5%, this is 0.3%. And so this is telling you that if you want information over a larger range of depth, like what is the mean density of the whole outer core, then you can get that more precisely, right, than if you want something over 200 or 300 kilometers. Okay, so I did this analysis to find out what the mean density of the outer core was and the mean density of the whole core. And why did I do that? Well, I did that because I wanted to compute what the density gradient was using the Adams-Williamson equation. And Bruce went over this a lifetime ago at the beginning of this workshop. And the idea here is that you have this adiabatic, well-mixed region. And from seismology, if this is what the density gradient would be, d rho by dr, in this adiabatic region, where this phi term is given by seismology, Vp squared minus 4/3 Vs squared. And in the outer core, that's just Vp squared, right? Okay, so this, I can integrate this equation for density if I know, it turns out, if I know the mass of the whole core and the mass of the outer core. That's all I need to know. And if you give me the seismic velocities, I can find out what density is. And it turns out that all the models that you get here, these are the seismic models that I used. You can see they're a little different. This is just for Vp. But they all give the same density. It runs right down the middle here, and then there's about 0.8 gram per cc density jump, and it comes down here. And these error bars just come from how well I can actually estimate the mass of the outer core and the mass of the total core. All right, so this is what I would expect the density gradient to look like, or the density profile to look like, if the whole of the outer core were adiabatic and well mixed. Now, my next question is, do the modes agree with that? Okay, and I'm going to try and make local averages of for density now, getting rid of Vp and Vs, and say, do they agree with this? I'm just doing the outer core here, so let's just see what I got. All right, so here's the corridor of Adams-Williamson models, and actually there's some lines on here which are a bunch of different models of density in the outer core. And then these are my local averages. Actually, with resolving widths of now of about 300 kilometers. So I'm averaging a little bit like 300 kilometers from here to here. And I don't know, it looks pretty good, right? There's a place here where you might say there's something funny going on, but I'm still within basically one standard deviation away from the Adams-Williamson condition. So this is an example of using the mode data to try and ask if the outer core is in a state of neutral stability, if it's consistent with being with being vigorously convecting. Of course, you can ask how big the change in density would be if it was stable, and that's kind of depressing. Sorry? This one of these funky ones, this brown one, I think is 1066A. These are all different Earth models, and they basically are slightly high. And that's something that the modes came up with. They wanted a slightly less massive outer core than most Earth models actually had. All right, so that's one of the reasons why the density jump at inner core boundary went up a little bit in these kinds of analyses. But you know, it's if there were reasonable departures from adiabaticity in the outer core, would you be able to see them? Okay, that's another question. Okay, and so this is what happens if you, to the density gradient, if you make the whole of the core be isothermal, right, which is about as stable as thermally you could possibly become. And so you do this relative to this. And so this is only a percent or so, and it's within this corridor. All right, so the likelihood is that if you have thermally stratified regions in the core, you won't be able to see them using modes. If you have chemically stratified regions, it turns out you might be able to see them. But this tells you that to within a standard deviation that the models are consistent with adiabaticity. Okay? So that's the kind of question that you can ask with the mode data set. This is VP in the lower mantle averaged over depth ranges of 250 to 300 kilometers. So you can see this is the kind of error bar that you get from the modes, and then there's a whole bunch of models there. Now, what we're really interested in is what's happening close to the core mantle boundary and what's happening close to the 660. And that's where I have a problem, right? Because I'm making little boxcars here. All right, and if I move my boxcar up to the boundary, then part of my boxcar goes into the core in this case, and my average starts shooting up because I'm averaging the core into my estimate. I can't just get the mantle on its own. I can only get so close to the core mantle boundary before I'm unable to make the resolving kernel be zero in the core. Okay, so this is about as close as I can get. If I go down in here, then it goes up, but it's not because the density in Dedel prime is going up, it's because I'm averaging part of the core into the estimate. Okay? Or this case, VP. All right, and the same is true here. So I'd like to really be able to distinguish between these guys, but the modes are unable to do that. They're unable to get that fine enough resolution to see exclusively underneath the 660. Okay, you have to get a little bit further away to about here. Okay, so, but this is the kind of precision that you mineral physicists should think that we can get, all right? We're talking about 0.5% or better, 0.3% in the lower mantle. And the same is true with VS, similar kind of analysis. Okay, so this... If you want to know, okay, there's one other way of getting at density at interfaces, and that's using the amplitudes of reflected phases, because they tell you about the impedance contrast. This is the best way to do it. All right, and you know, you can do it to about 0.3%. Right, which ain't too bad. Now, I did the same analysis for the Adams-Williamson equation in the lower mantle, where you wouldn't necessarily expect the Adams-Williamson to work, because you all know now that internally heated flows tend to look subadiabatic, right? So, because you've all been playing with Bruce's code. And this is the corridor of models that you get, assuming everything follows the Adams-Williamson equation. And of course, in the models, there's something funny going on here, and this is AK135. It has a funky density in the Dedel prime. But it's actually true that the modes, when you average, they jig around a little bit, but they're basically consistent with this general increase in density as given by the Adams-Williamson. You could probably make it be isothermal, and you wouldn't see much change. And unfortunately, I still can't resolve things on the scale length of a couple hundred kilometers at either end. I'm probably just trying to be a little bit too aggressive in how narrow I make my boxcars. And typically that will happen if you start getting little bits of sensitivity to VP and VS, and you know, you don't perfectly wipe out everything else. So I'm just probably being a little bit too aggressive. I was trying to get as close to these sides as I possibly could, which is what was driving that. But yeah, and then you start getting this little jiggling, And so, this jiggle is actually the same for every starting model. It doesn't matter which model I use. I can use AK135. If I use this model as the starting model and I compute the local average, I get this. Okay, so it's, AK135 doesn't look like that. What? These are averaged over about 300 kilometers. It depends whether you're a one standard deviation or a two standard deviation person, I guess. If you're a two standard deviation person, then you'd probably say no. But if you're a one standard deviation person, you'd say, yeah. Yeah, they become smoother. So you get wilder oscillations as you make them narrow and narrow. Okay, so I'm just trying to give you a feel for how well the models are actually determined inside the Earth, and they're pretty precise. So, if you're trying to fit the shear velocity or the compression velocity, you should probably be aiming for something that fits to within a few tenths of a percent. Okay. No. if you think of the Adams-Williamson equation, you can think of d rho dr minus rho g over phi being multiplied by some factor which is dependent upon the amount of stability that you have. And that factor is for an isothermal core. Okay, so instead of having this, I would have this thing multiplied by some parameter called eta, which would be very close to 1. And for an isothermal core, that number is 1 plus alpha T gamma, where alpha is the thermal expansion coefficient, T is temperature, and gamma is Grunison's ratio. And that number is about 0.05 in the lower mantle. It's about 0.08 in the core. So you're only changing the density gradient by a few percent when you do that. And when you integrate, the change isn't very much. Yeah.
It seemed to go to a minimum near the CMB.
They do funny things. Yeah, and part of the problem for that is that you're actually sensitive to the locations of the discontinuities as well. So I'm actually asking my multipliers to remove all sensitivity to the location of the discontinuities as well as to VP and VS when I'm looking for rho. So I'm asking these things to do an awful lot. But the kernels for how much you change the frequency if you change the core mantle boundary, they are similar to what happens when you actually change structure on either side of the core mantle boundary. So typically, I would have expected that these things would go up because you're trying to annihilate something which has a similar shape to something you want to be nice and big, all right? So you're trying to make something big, but at the same time, you want something like next to it to be small. And so that tends to reduce the resolution a little bit. I'm not quite sure why it comes down, but this would have been my expected behavior. It would go up there, right at the boundaries. Inner core is kind of a lost cause, really. Never mind. I guess we know the mean shear velocity of about a percent or so. Okay, so the reason I did this was to look, well, one of the reasons I did this, and there's a paper on the web there which discusses this, is to try and get the density jump of the core mantle boundary better. So that's where the 0.8 grams per cc came from, with an error of about 0.18 grams per cc. So it's from this kind of analysis. And there are some conflicting numbers in the literature that come from looking at how well pK little IKP is reflected off the core mantle boundary. Barbara has a paper which agrees with us, so we must be right. But there's another person who has a paper which doesn't agree with us, and so there's some there's some question still about that. But you have to bear in mind that with the modes, you're looking at the density difference between the bottom of the outer core averaged over a few hundred kilometers and the top of the inner core averaged over a few hundred kilometers, because that's all I can say. I'm not really telling you what the density difference is right at the inner core boundary. And the other thing was to look at the stealth layer, all right, which is the layer at the base of the mantle where we're supposed to put all the goodies that all the geochemists don't want to see. And typically, in actual fact, the local averages for the lower mantle are all pretty much consistent with a standard Adams-Williamson type increase. And if you average over the bottom 500 kilometers of the lower mantle here, you find that the density here could be 0.4% denser than you predict from the rise from the Adams-Williamson equation. And that's right on our uncertainty. That's about as well as we can do it. So this is, I don't know whether such a layer would be stable. If you read the Kellogg et al. Paper where they have this hot, denser layer, it's hot, so it counteracts the chemical difference, but the total difference in density is still about 1%. And you need to maintain some kind of density difference like that for it to be dynamically stable. And what I'm saying is that it's probably the density contrast from the modes on average is probably less than a factor of 2 smaller than that. All right, so then the question is, would that be a dynamically stable feature? Yeah, it could. You can always do that. You can make it thinner. All right. I mean, I'm talking about the Kellogg model where you have a lot of topography on this rather large layer at the bottom. But if you do the spherical average of that, then which is what the modes are doing, right? Then you should still be able to see the mean density increase that would be there in the models, and you don't. Okay. Now you can put it in the bottom 250 kilometers, and I'm screwed. I can't make an averaging kernel small enough to give you a number that would be interesting, right? Because I can only tell you what the density is to 10 or 15%, and then who cares, right?
What are the seismology results? Do they have sensitivity
with that scale? Well, these are the seismology results, basically. I'll come to the 3D constraints on density in the lower mantle later, assuming you get it. Well, in the spherical case, I've done this calculation assuming the whole mantle has radial anisotropy. So you have 5 elastic moduli in density, and the modes can wipe them out. Right? So you get the same answer. So you're actually able to do that calculation. And it's fine. Okay, I was going to talk about attenuation in the Earth, but maybe I won't. Well, maybe I will a little bit. Attenuation in the Earth is another problem that we do using the modes. We have observations of the queues of modes. This is the imaginary part, if you like. And we parameterize the imaginary part of the elastic moduli, which are going to give you that imaginary part of the frequency, which gives you the decay, right, by these Q values, Q kappa and Q mu. And you have to distinguish between a K and a kappa here. All right, so there's a kappa. This is a K. All right. Easy. All right. So what we do, so the I mu over Q mu is the imaginary part. Goes in there. And this part goes over here. So the measurements of the decay rates are related to Q kappa and Q mu, actually the inverse is inside the Earth. And these guys, the K and the M, there are just the kernels that you've been plotting with IgPix. All right. So they're the actual kernels that you've been plotting. And we have maybe 300 or 400 mode observations, which are Q observations, which are reasonably precise. Precise here meaning to order of a few percent, right? Because attenuation is so hard to measure. And you can't get very much complexity in the Earth from a few hundred mode measurements, which are precise to a few percent. So this is kind of the best that we do. The black line here is a model called QL6 by Durek and Ekstrom, and with some new mode measurements, we got the red model, which is, this is 1,000 over Q, so high means strongly attenuating. This is the inner core, lower mantle, upper mantle, this is the asthenosphere, and you can see that basically what this tells you is that all of the attenuation at least spherically averaged, is happening in the asthenosphere, and it's happening in the inner core. Well, I'm going to get into an argument with Barbara if I answer that question, but I'll answer it anyway. Okay. It turns out that the fundamental mode cues, I believe that we can measure them fairly accurately. This is the fit of QL6. And if I want to make this thing wrap onto this line of measurements here, this is 0 SL modes, 1,000 over Q versus harmonic degree, then I have to make that asthenosphere be even more attenuating. So if I do that, then I can pull the model around this corner. Okay, so it's just fit to the fundamental modes. Which one do you want? What, out here? Yeah, well, you know, they all depart a little bit. I mean, this one does the same thing. And it's because we're only using 5 or 6 layers models. I should probably have some more layers up the top here to characterize this. Sorry? The very low L? Yeah, this model takes a little dip here, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, it goes down.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not sure I really want to get into it because it's, as you can see, it's a fairly subtle difference. If you measure modes, you can measure the cues of the fundamental modes in two ways. Okay, you can pretend that they're traveling waves, Rayleigh waves, and measure their attenuation as they go around the Earth, or you can look in the frequency domain and think of them as standing waves and measure their decay, measure how much amplitude of a peak decays as you go along in time. And those two methods in the past have given different answers for a certain range of harmonic degrees where they overlap. And it turns out that both, in my opinion, both measurements have sources of bias in them that means that the true answer is somewhere in between them. All right. And I've demonstrated that the mode measurements, if you remember when I was picking 0S25, and there were peaks on either side, 0S26 and 0S24, it turns out that interference from those guys does bias the cue that you get in the middle. All right, so if you take care of that, then you'll get a slightly different answer. And if you, depending on how you do the surface wave observation, you can get a cue that's consistent and consistent with the mode observation. Okay, so, all right, so that's enough 1D stuff. Now there's going to be a lot of it can be shown that's here for the 3D stuff. And of course what we're shooting for here is stuff that looks like this, all right? So here's a mode 13S2 and these 1, 2, 3 peaks that you see there actually all belong to 13S2, okay? And so what we're seeing now is mode splitting caused by departures from symmetry. So just like the energy levels of a hydrogen atom, undistorted hydrogen atom, are degenerate, then it turns out that the mode frequencies for a spherical Earth are degenerate. And there are 2L+1 modes which have exactly the same frequency. If I put some 3D structure in, I'm going to remove that degeneracy, and each of those 2L+1 modes may have a different frequency. Okay? So I get splitting. And sometimes it's resolvable. You know, with 13S2, it turns out there are only 5 lines in this little frequency band here, and they tend to come in doublets, it turns out. So this is the plus minus 2 line, plus minus 1 line, and 0 line. And they come in doublets because the structure that this is dominantly sensitive to is axisymmetric. Maybe I'll get to explain that to you. So what we do is to try and take apart the splitting and relate that to 3D structure inside the Earth. Okay? So just like the center frequency tells you about the spherically average structure, the splitting can be used to tell you about 3D structure. So if you take 13S2 apart, this is what you get. You can think of this as being the shape of a spheroidal mode on the vertical component instrument is just a YLM. All right. So if you have axisymmetric structure, okay, on a spherical Earth, they're just YLMs. On an aspherical Earth, every singlet, each of the two L plus one singlets is a linear combination of all of the five spherical Earth singlets. Generally speaking, that is true. If you have axisymmetric structure, it's not true, and each aspherical Earth singlet is still a YLM. Okay? And that can be important. So this thing is dominantly sensitive to axisymmetric structure. It turns out that structure is anisotropy in the inner core. All right, and so you see the zero line plus minus one doublet plus or minus two doublet. And this is what you predict for the splitting due to a rotating Earth in hydrostatic equilibrium. So you predict about so many microhertz, 4 or 5 microhertz across. What you observe is these guys, which is, I don't know, was it 16 some microhertz. So this mode is split by more than a factor of 2 than you would expect just from a rotating Earth in hydrostatic equilibrium. So this kind of splitting is not a small signal, right? It's enormous. Okay, it's very easy to see. And it was a puzzle to me for a long time. Okay, so that's the kind of data we're going to look at. Those modes are pretty anomalous. I'll come back to those at the end. Okay, here comes that it can be shown that. All right. Now with modes, modes basically are YLMs, and the way they sample the Earth means that they're filters of 3D structure. So if you have an L equal 2 mode, it's a very long wavelength, and it can't see arbitrarily small things at all right? So what it sees is long wavelength structure. So it makes sense to parameterize structure in terms of spherical harmonics when you're looking at them with modes. All right, and so this is about the only time it makes sense to do this. But, okay, so what we do is we expand our model. This would be delta rho, delta vp, delta vs, whatever, in terms of spherical harmonics like this. And then it turns out these structure coefficients, these CSTs, are integrals over depth of these coefficients in this expansion now, with a kernel as a function of radius. So this is like the 1D problem where we had perturbations in frequency related to the perturbations in the spherical average of the Earth. Now we have similar linear problems, but from these coefficients here, which we're going to try and estimate somehow in terms of the expansion coefficients in the model. So this is what we'd like to know, so we know what the 3D structure is. Okay, the CSTs work their way into the theories through something called the splitting matrix, which looks like this, all right? And then these things are just geometric factors, okay? The eigenvalues of this matrix are the perturbations in frequency about the mean frequency of the singlets. So they're telling me how much each singlet is perturbed away in frequency from the degenerate frequency. The eigenvectors tell me how I'm supposed to combine my YLMs in the spherical Earth case to get the new shapes of the new aspherical Earth singlets. All right, so everything is in the splitting matrix. What one take-home idea that you want to do is if we could estimate these CSTs for a particular mode, then we can just make a function. We can just do an expansion here with some spherical harmonics and make a function of theta and phi, which is a graphical view of how that mode sees 3D structure. Okay? So just like a phase velocity map, is a view of how a 100-second radio wave sees aspherical structure, then these splitting functions is a way of visualizing how a mode sees 3D structure, how the 3D structure integrated over depth with these kinds of of weights as a function of depth, these wiggly functions that you've been plotting in IPix. Okay, now, this guy here, this gamma function is important because it describes the interaction of the mode with the structure. Okay? And generally speaking, I can have two modes talking to each other and also talking to 3D structure. Or I can have two singlets within a multiplet talking to each other and talking to 3D structure. Okay, and that's what I have if I have, if I pretend I have isolated multiplets, then I would just have singlets within a multiplet coupling through 3D structure. And it turns out this gamma function, and this is on page 125 of the class notes, so all you have to do is read the first bunch. This gamma function here is an integral over three spherical harmonics. All right, this is telling you how one singlet in a multiplet will interact with another and through the structure. All right, and so these are all functions of theta and phi. And that integral will usually be zero, okay? Because they're different wiggly functions, all right? And if modes are wiggly enough in different ways, they can't sense each other or they can't sense the structure. Does that make physical sense? All right, because remember, we're dealing with L equal two modes, so you know, they have enormous wavelengths, so they don't care about degree 40 structure. They just, you know, they don't care. But what do they care about? Well, each of these has an e to the im phi term in here, so if you want this to be non-zero, it turns out you have to have this condition, minus m plus t plus m prime is equal to zero, where the m's are the azimuthal order numbers of the two singlets. So if t is zero, which would be axisymmetric structure, right? Anytime you have a CST with a t zero, that corresponds to p20, p40, whatever, then it tells you that m must equal m prime, all right? So only for axisymmetric structure, then m is equal to m prime, and it turns out that this splitting matrix is diagonal, but that's neither here nor there. Now, from the properties of the Legendre functions that go into these things, the PLMs, remember a YLM is a PLM times the e to the im phi, then the PLMs are polynomials in theta in co-latitude, and you have to make that polynomial be even about the equator when you multiply two modes together. Otherwise, you're going to get a big fat zero when you do that integral. Okay, if it's anti-symmetric about the equator, then you're going to get a big fat zero. So you require, so to make this thing be non-zero, we require this rule. And so, wait a minute, this rule. Okay, L plus S plus L prime has to be equal, even, all right, for this thing not to go to zero. So if we're looking at an isolated multiplet where L prime and L are the same, right, so I'm just looking at two singlets within a multiplet, then that tells you that 2L plus S has to be even. Now, 2L is always even, right? So that tells you that S has to be even, okay? That tells you that an isolated multiplet is only sensitive to even order structure. It's only sensitive to degree 2, degree 4, degree 6, degree 8. All right, now that's a fundamental limitation of modes. You can think of them as standing waves, which are really traveling waves interfering, going around like this, and because you're looking at multiple orbits, you average out all the odd order structure and you're just left with things the way you have bumps opposite bumps and dents opposite dents. Okay, so you just average it all out. It doesn't, you're not sensitive to odd order structure. For an isolated multiple, that's true. This is the last selection rule, supposedly, and this tells you that for an isolated multiple, that 0 is less than S is less than 2L. Okay, so that tells you that 13S2 is sensitive only to degree 2 0 and degree 2 structure and degree 4 structure. Right, because we only go up to 2L. So an L equal 2 mode only goes up to 4. So these things are incredibly good filters of structure, right? Which is good and which is bad, right? Everybody would like to know, you know, everything on the scale length of a kilometer inside the Earth, and modes won't do that. But if you want to know what the large scale structure is, then modes are really good at doing that, as long as you're only interested in the even order structure. If you want odd order structure, then you have to look at coupled modes, and it turns out that I don't think there really have been enough coupled systems analyzed to get a handle on odd order structure yet, but it will happen. Okay, so we did the selection rules. So what are modes good for? Well, let me just show you some CSTs. Here are some CSTs. Okay. So these are the degree 2 structure coefficients for fundamental modes, and they go up to degree 40 or degree 60. So these we know pretty well. But these just sample the upper mantle. They're not that interesting, right? You probably made some pictures of fundamental mode kernels. And so, I don't know. I mean, down the bottom here we're sampling. But you see, we know these things pretty well. If we look at 1S modes, which are more interesting, because these sample down towards the base of the mantle, then these are some. This is C20, C22. These are measured in microhertz. And this is as a function of the harmonic degree. So this is 1S2, 1S3, 1S4, 1S5, 1S6. And there are some estimates, different estimates here. You can see that they move around from author to author. But there are basic trends in the data that have to be there. You can't get bouncing around like this because the kernel of this one is very like the kernels of this one, right? So you cannot really see very different structure inside the Earth between 1S6 and 1S7 because they sample the Earth in very similar ways. So just by looking at a long branch consistency, you can come up with some error bars. And some of these terms are quite big. This term's typically big, and the C22 term is typically big. Okay, so we have a bunch of these CSTs for even order structure only, and we want to do something with them. Okay, so let me just show you some of these splitting functions. All right, here's a mode, 5S8. Okay, this is the data. This is a splitting function, and this has structure of 2, 4, and 6 in. Now, every single one of these things has antipodal symmetry, right? So that's really, just think about that. That means if I have a spike in structure on the surface of the Earth, a delta function on the surface of the Earth, and I expand it out in spherical harmonics, and then I just look at the even order harmonics, then this thing's going to have a bulge on the opposite side of the Earth, right? So by looking at the degree 2 coefficients, or the even order coefficients for density and bulk sound speed, let's suppose I did that, then I could have a spike in density on one side of the Earth and a spike in bulk sound speed on the other side of the Earth, and those spherical harmonic patterns in even order would agree perfectly, even though the structure was in completely different places. Right, so you have to bear that in mind. Of course, it turns out that the lowermost mantle is dominantly degree 2, so we're in good shape. But it might not have been that way. Okay, so this is what I would call a standard mode. All right, this is a model of the crust and mantle. This is what it predicts, and if you take the difference, there's not much left. Okay, and it's sensitive to p velocity in the lower mantle. This is a fundamental mode. Okay. So this is like a very filtered version of a phase velocity map. It's just 2, 4, and 6 harmonics. All right, so it has antipodal symmetry. This is what the models predict, and that's what the difference is. So these guys that sample the mantle, we have models of the mantle which work pretty well. This is a different kind of mode, which has energy in the inner core. This is what the data look like, which has very large blue caps. Okay, this is what the crust and mantle predicts. All right, and this is what the difference is. It's almost the same as this. And this is one of these anomalously split modes which sample into the inner core. All right, so we basically have two classes of modes. We have modes which are normal, and we have modes which are anomalously split. And it turns out that every single one of those anomalously split modes has a little tail sampling into the inner core. All right, so now we're going to do an inversion. I'm probably going to make Miyake cross now, because this is a slightly controversial subject. This subject being modes, as you know, are sensitive to density, right? Body waves aren't. So what we would like to do is to use the modes to tell us something about density. I would really like to know whether my big slow blobs in the middle of the Pacific and in Africa, are they high density or low density, right? That would be really nice to know. If it's thermal, then they're probably going to be low density. If they're compositional, they could be high density. They may not be upwellings at all, right? They're just slow. Okay, so Stan probably didn't like that, never mind. So we do the inversion. We have CSTs that look like this. We do an inversion for long wavelength structure, degree 2, 4, and 6 structure inside the Earth. And I'm going to do a few inversions here. And the data set that I'm using is this compilation of all the CSTs that we have measured and other people have measured with error bars that make all the along branch consistency be sensible and all that stuff. So this is a hybrid data set of everybody's data that I could possibly find, and you know, making a sensible summary of it as I possibly could. Okay, so I did a couple of inversions here. One where I'm solving for bulk sound speed and shear velocity. And first of all, I fixed the density in this particular case to look like the bulk sound speed. Okay. Now it turns out that when you do the top stuff is just what's happening in the upper mountain. We don't care about that. Just look at the bottom here. So this is shear velocity. This is a slice through the earth in the Diabol prime. This is density, and it has to look like this because I forced it to look like that. All right, I use the scaling. Okay, so it turns out that of these three things, the sensitivity to density is the weakest. So the question is, if I make this happen, how well do I fit the data? But what you have to bear in, what you have to take from this is that the natural inversion will always give you a bulk sound speed that's negatively correlated with a shear velocity. Okay, and that's a really important result. Now, as long as the mantle is dominantly degree 2, so that this represents localization of structure in the mantle, and remember it's just an even harmonic expansion, it's just 2, 4, and 6, then I could say that, yes, this is really exciting. The bulk sound speed here is not correlated positively with the shear velocity, and that would be totally inconsistent with a thermal origin for these anomalies. Okay? So that always happens, it turns out. Now what I can do is I can make density be proportional to shear velocity, and I do the same inversion, and now density dutifully becomes proportional to shear velocity, and I get a slightly different fit to the data. But bulk sound speed is always negatively correlated with shear velocity. And then finally I can let all three go free, and I get something that looks like this, and then this is where some people would differ in what you get when you let everything go free. It turns out that my density here is now very small, but it is actually positively correlated with the shear velocity. Now, the caveat to all this is that all of these models fit the data about the same. Okay, so if I make the only thing number that really changes here, these are chi-squares before and after. Just look at the degree 2 component for spheroidal modes. And if I make density proportional to bulk sound speed, I get a final chi-squared over n of 1.4. Proportional to Vs is 1.1. If I just let it go free, it's 0.9. But you know, the difference between 1 and 1.4 would be the effect of increasing my errors by 20%. So do I know my errors to 20%? And I would say I probably don't. So if you do it like this, then you would say right now that the modes don't have the capability of determining whether density is positively or negatively correlated at the base of the mantle. They do tell you that the bulk sound speed is inversely correlated with shear velocity. That always comes out. Now, there are papers out in the literature. Miyake here just published one, came out last week in PEPI, which says that density is positively correlated with the shear velocity. Density is high when shear velocity is low, right? Which would definitely have to be a chemical effect. And then these big blobs would probably not be terribly buoyant. And why are we getting different answers? Well, the answer is that we're all using slightly different data sets. And the data set I used was a compilation of everything that I tried to make as internally consistent as possible. I think Miyake is using everything and putting it all in inversion, which is another way of doing it. I think that my own personal feeling is that this is still up for grabs. And one thing that you can realize from this, though, is that we're not using any information from all of the body wave stuff that we have when we do this. And of course, the body waves are sensitive to the bulk sound speed and the shear velocity, and we need to somehow get all that information into this process to really answer this question correctly. And you could do that. You can project the data onto spherical harmonics and use the body wave data as well to learn about long wavelength structure.
originated. We're also inverted for water payment continuity.
Right.
Which I think would be a huge contribution.
Well, these inversions include topography on the Cormel boundary in 616 and 410. I haven't looked at the trade-off between the two, but yes, I would think that there would be a trade-off. Okay, so if Miyake wants to get up and jump up and down, she should. Okay, the last thing. All right, so that's something that modes are good for. They could, in principle, tell you about density if things were just a little bit more precise and we had our act together. And so I think that's going to happen pretty soon. The last thing I want to talk about is something that modes are ideally suited for, which is looking at rotation of the inner core. Okay. Now, rotation of the inner core has been looked at using body waves, and the idea is that you look at the difference between the PKP BC, which goes just above the core inner core boundary, and the DF, which goes in the inner core, and you look for time variations in travel time residuals, right, which might be due to the inner core turning underneath you as you sample it. Now, the trouble with that is with body waves is that you're just sampling the inner core in one very small place, and you can only do this experiment at certain distance ranges, so you're only sampling very small parts of the inner core. Modes just see the whole thing, right? They see large-scale structure. So if you want to say that the inner core is rotating relative to the mantle at a degree per year, then if you look at how the modes see structure over a 20-year period, then that pattern should have moved by 20 degrees. Right, which is not a small signal. We should be able to see that. Okay, so that's conceptually what we did. Let me see if I can find. So here's a bunch of anomaly split modes. These all sample the inner core a little bit. And every single one of these has this huge blue cap here, which tells you that what's dominantly causing the splitting here is this axisymmetric structure. Means that the anisotropy in the inner core has to dominantly be aligned with the rotation axis. So you have fast direction aligned with the rotation axis. So in a global sense, the modes need to have that. You can screw around with the body waves and you can put stuff in odd order harmonics, but you better have a big P20, a big axisymmetric term in the anisotropy, otherwise you won't get this effect. Now, if you want to look at rotation, what you want is something that varies geographically, all right? Something like these guys. So you can look at these red blobs and say, okay, do those red blobs translate with time? Okay, so these are the ideal modes that you would like to have. A mode like 13S1 isn't much use because its splitting function is axisymmetric. So if I rotate the inner core, I just get the same thing, all right? So I need to have non-axisymmetric structure to be able to do this, and some of these modes do have this funny little pattern here, which is not part of the mantle. I'll show that. So what conceptually we do is, because we don't do this, but what we do is we would take a splitting function measured from old earthquakes here being the late 70s, early 80s, okay, and from new earthquakes, which would be the late 90s. Early 2000. And we make the splitting function. This actually is from Shandong Li, a Harvard group in from early 80s and late 70s data. This is what ours looks like. There's a lot more data in this, so this is probably more precise. If you correct for the mantle structure, which shouldn't change with time, which doesn't look like either of these, then you get this and this. And so there's roughly a 20-year difference between these guys. And it's quite clear from looking at these that they haven't rotated by massive amounts, right? That's pretty clear. Well, we've done this with five different mantle models, and including the ones that have the anticorrelation of bulk sound speed and shear velocity, and we always get the same answer. So, but like Stan, you know, do I really believe anything here? At some point, I'm not sure. But okay, this actually isn't really quite how we do this, but you can think of this as being the way that we do it. And what should happen if the inner core is rotating is that this whole pattern should rotate as a coherent whole. Now you can ask how the degree 2 part of this rotates, which goes in eastward a little bit, and how the degree 4 part rotates, this which goes westward a little bit, which of course is nonsense, right? And then the average is just a little bit westward, okay? And so not only do you have to get a coherent pattern rotating, but every single mode that you look at has to get the same answer, right? If it really is rotation of the inner core. So you can do this with a whole bunch of different modes. And I should just point out that some of these modes have really, the inner core boundary is here. So some of these modes have respectable tails in the inner core, but some of them have tiny tails. This guy here, the inner core boundary is about there. This guy is enormously split and he has this tiny little tail in the inner core, but he still manages to be split. Okay, so here's another example. That was 13S2, this is 13S3, same kind of deal. Okay, so the blobs and the old one and the new one are pretty much the same. If you look at the different components, they go in different directions, but in the average is pretty close to zero. And you can do this for a whole bunch of modes. And what you find is that some modes appear to go westward, and for some modes that go eastward, and on average, you get a mean of about 0.2 degrees per year. So ideally, all of these would have gotten the same answer, and it would have all lined up like that. But all of them are getting slightly different answers. But this is, I think this really is the best way of doing this problem, because the modes are naturally filtering out the large wavelength structure, so you're looking at big blobs. You don't have to worry about sampling little parts of a very complicated inner core. And you can ask if those big blobs are moving. And the answer is that maybe, all right? To within the precision of the measurement for this number of modes, then you've got about 0.2 degrees per year, but zero would certainly be within one standard deviation. But anyway, it's just another example of what you can use modes for.
Some modes, how you remove, what model you use to remove the density structure matters, and what most of them don't, so like 9S3 won't.
Right. So it's just the way the kernels are inside the Earth. And so you should believe ones where basically the effect of all the different models is the same, because then they're not so sensitive to mantle structure as we understand it. Okay, but unfortunately, the examples of those in this direction and examples of those in this direction too. So still the answer is very close to zero. Okay? Of course, what we do is to use all the data now, because we don't believe the inner core is really rotating. But we have data from 77 through 82 is the old stuff, and there were maybe 6 or 7 really big earthquakes in that interval. It turns out that the 80s sucked, right? There were no big earthquakes in the 80s, except 89, there was the Macquarie Ridge earthquake. But the 80s sucked for lots of reasons, right? So starting in 94, we started getting big earthquakes. And I would say that this data set is about 96 through 2002. So it ascended about 98, 99. So we're looking from 79, 80 to 98, 99. If the inner core rotating, then this pattern should move 20 degrees. This should have moved 20 degrees relative to this.
And what you're saying is you don't see that.
I don't see it. Do you
see
it?
Right. I don't see that. But you're using also the data that they use. So does that mean?
Well, this stuff was published in the mid 80s, and it used data from the late 70s and early 80s. So no, I mean, we can do the same thing. I mean, it's the same process to get the splitting function from the data, whether you use old data or new data. All right, you're just binning the data in different ways.
Sure,
This is only recent earthquakes.
Only, okay.
This is only old earthquakes. This is only recent earthquakes.
I thought you said that you used all the data in the most recent
one. There's a lot more data in the recent one. Okay, just because now we have 100, 150 recordings per earthquake, whereas in the 70s we maybe had 20 recordings per earthquake.
But you're not using the 70s in the...
No, this is a completely separate data set. This is centered on 1979, 1980, roughly, and this is centered on 1998, 1999, roughly. But this one is more precisely determined than this one just because there's a whole hell of a lot more data in it, because we have much bigger networks. Right. Well, for the mantle structure, I have done inversions using both the inner core sensitive modes and not using the inner core sensitive modes, because the inner core sensitive modes are also sensitive to the mantle, as you can see from the corrections that we have to make. So you can do it both ways, but you have to do an inversion for inner core structure simultaneously with mantle structure, or you can just forget about the anomaly split modes and only look at the Rayleigh split modes to look at the mantle structure separately, which is the inversions that I showed you. Okay. All right.
Guy, the cylindrical symmetry that you normally talk about, that would be in elliptical symmetry.
It's this P2-0. These are totally saturated caps here. If you were to plot them so that the color scale wasn't saturated, you wouldn't be able to see the structure in the middle. And it's because the thing that's really splitting these things to hell is this axisymmetric component. And that doesn't tell you anything about rotation, right? But it's... If you would model it as this axisymmetric, with a fast axis parallel to the rotation axis, it comes out looking like a P20, P40 anomaly. It looks like an anomalous ellipticity, basically, which it's not obvious, but it's true. It can be shown that. All right, so that's all I want to say about modes, and next time we'll talk about putting everything together to learn about mantle structure. Okay.